You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
I'm often asked if it's intimidating cooking for celebrities who come to the River Cafe. My response is that the guests who really worry me are other chefs. It's a bit like that today as I'm about to interview the interviewer, Mariella Frostrup, especially since I was once the subject for Guardian's Lunch with Mariella. Mariella wrote, "Despite such eloquence, Ruthie is a disaster of an interview. My questions get longer as her answers get shorter and inevitably end with a question for me. She's all, don't you think, and do you find, and have you noticed? But I'm reminding myself that I'm not here with Mariella the journalist, but Mariella, my good friend. When Mariella books a table in the River Cafe, it's most often for two, usually with her husband, human rights lawyer, Jason McHugh. Watching her is watching someone who's diverted only by what she is eating and drinking, as she's entirely focused to the person she's with, sitting close, talking, smiling, laughing, and listening. Her daughter Molly, who's working here as a barback, told me about growing up with her mother, cooking together, eating together, traveling together to Norway, to Greece, all over the world. Now Mariella and I will do the same. Intimidated? Why would I be? Don't you think? Do you find? Do you notice?"
Oh, Ruthie, that's the best introduction I've ever had, ever in my entire life, don't you think? How would you like to be described, Ruthie? I'm sorry I said that, but it is true.
It's true. You said it was really sweet of me. You said you just kept turning the questions back on me. So today I'm just going to listen to you and not say, don't you think? But before we do, first of all, I'm so happy you're here. I love having Molly here. She's just fantastic.
I think she feels like she's at a West End show every night of her life. Because she's a barback, so she's behind the counter.
Who did the cooking when you were, you know, in your house?
Well, in our house, it was very 50-50.
Would you have Sunday lunches? Was there one meal that you would have that would be...
We would have Sunday lunches. Yeah. And I'd say the most important thing of our Sunday lunch was probably the Yorkshire puddings. Mm. My dad was obsessed with them. He'd have like 50 at least.
Your mom grew up in Norway. Do you have a connection, food connection to Norway?
So we go to Norway sometimes on holiday because, I mean, it's so beautiful. And obviously, like, mum likes the fact that we all get to see, we sort of wear... we're from and stuff, but I wouldn't really say that there was a sort of dish that we remember. Norwegian. There's this sort of cheese that mum's obsessed with, but none of us like so much.
Norwegian cheese.
Yeah, it's really? Something. It's like, and it's a very brown colour, and it's very smelly and sweet and weird. Yeah. It's not for me.
Okay. I can't understand. None of my family are converted to it.
What is wrong with them?
I think it's probably heavily processed and not necessarily good for you, but it is a taste of childhood. It's called Yai toast, and it's a goat's cheese, but it's... I'm going to make it sound disgusting. It looks sort of caramel coloured.
It's called brun
cheese, because the thing about Norwegian is that it's very literal. You know, if you pass a lake and it's got brown water, it'll be called Brun Lake.
Oh, okay.
You know, if you pass a house and it's the first one in the row, it'll be called Hus One.
Okay.
And so Brun cheese is brun what cheese. It gets called.
Okay. This gives us a chance to start at the very beginning. Norway. You were born in Norway? Where?
Born in Oslo in 1962, where my dad had moved back. He and my mother met at Edinburgh. Mm. She was a very young art student. She was 16 when they first met. She'd started art college 2 years early. She was an incredible talent, but this was the end of the 1950s. Yeah. He was studying English at Edinburgh University, as a lot of Scandinavians, well, they still do, but a lot of Norwegians particularly go to Edinburgh. Mm. So they met there, and when she was 18, she gave up art college and went back with him to Norway, where I was born, and then my brother, and then my sister in fairly quick succession.
Do you remember the food that you ate when you were in Norway? What age did you leave Norway?
Six.
Oh, so you might not remember.
Yeah, but you know, there's a really weird thing I think that happens. I mean, firstly, my main food memory of Norway is actually because at that time in the 1960s, they really didn't have many ingredients at all. You know, there wasn't this sort of globalization of food. And, you know, you'd get strawberries, but only in midsummer. Yeah. There was a lot of pickling, fish and vegetables. Salt cod, which I didn't like at all. But I do remember, and I still love it, there's an Arctic chard, that they do that's just, I mean, I think one of the most delicious pieces of fish in the world. But because of that, I think I do remember things like cheese. We would always have cheese at breakfast. And strawberry jam wasn't like strawberry jam that you get here in jars and things. It would be fresh-made strawberry jam. They'd make it, and it would last until the next summer. Yeah. And so you would have a saucer full of it, and you would just spoon it onto your cheese, on your crackers or on your rye bread. And I remember things like that, but the thing I remember most was, I think it was difficult times, and I think it was difficult with my parents, and they weren't very happy Norway. Very young, and my mum had sort of given up all of her artistic expression to go there, and suddenly she had three children, and it was the 1950s, and Norway was very, very conservative then. And my father used to travel a lot because of his work. He was a journalist. And he came back from a trip to Tanzania. And he arrived back, and this will show you how long ago it was, with a box full of fruit. It had things we'd never seen before. Wow. It had mangoes and these extraordinary melons and then breadfruit and just all of these things. And it was like a miracle. It was like sunshine had just, it was like all the windows had opened and sunshine just blazed into our apartment. And I'll never forget it. You know, it was a really, really strong and striking memory from a period of time where I don't have that many memories. But what I was going to say about sense memory to do with food is I don't remember much about the food there. But when I go back, I'm like the woman in the tin drum in the film. Yeah. I'm like her, the one who can't stop eating fish. Yeah. I'm sat there with jars of herrings. I can't get enough sursil, you know, I can't pickle everything. Pickled gherkins, everything.
And did your father miss it, do you think? Did you have any of it in Ireland?
We used to get sursil. We would get pickled fish in jars because you couldn't get that in Ireland then. I'm not sure that he missed it. He was never much of a food man, my father. He was more of a drink man.
Ah, okay.
So his interest in food was sort of minimal.
Can you remember sitting down at meals with them and as a child? And was it dinners or lunches?
It was the 1970s, Ruthie.
Yeah.
And I don't think we did a lot of sitting down for meals. And also because it was always complicated, they split up when I was eight. Mm. So I think those sort of family moments were very few and far between, which is probably why Jason and I have been so kind of committed to creating them to a point where my children are like, oh no, not Sunday lunch, please.
But as you grew up in Ireland, so what was it like growing up? You were quite poor. You said that you had very little money.
Yeah, and so food, you know, in terms of, you know, defining childhood food memories, they tend to be not very not very warm and cozy ones. I mean, the awful, awful memory once when we really had run out of food. And my brother, who was always the one who tried to be emollient, he is still the kindest man you'll meet. And he was trying to make light of the fact that there literally was nothing in the cupboard. And he was like, look, I've got spaghetti and I've got golden syrup. It'll be delicious.
So you wouldn't have... He wasn't going to have the golden syrup after the spaghetti.
He made it for us with the golden syrup. It was one of the most disgusting combinations I've ever come across.
Did you say it at the time? Did anybody able
no,
to eat it?
No, we grinned and went, this is good, lovely, sugar and starch.
That's
what
kind
could
of,
be
yeah,
bad?
Yeah, you can have, it's like rice pudding, I suppose. How long did you live in Ireland for?
Till I was 16.
Yeah, and 16. Your father died while you were there?
He died when I was 15. He was 46. He had a heart attack. attack. For years.
Yeah, that was what, 70s?
78.
Yeah.
And then I moved to London in 79.
So when you came to, after the tragedy of your father's death, is that when you moved from Ireland?
Yeah.
Right after that?
Very
so
shortly.
So the whole, all three of you and your mom?
No, me.
What, by yourself?
Yeah.
How old were you?
Well, I'd already left home.
What age?
I left home when I was 15. I lived with my mum for quite a while, but my stepfather and I didn't get on, and he was not nice.
Okay.
And so then I went to live with my father, but that was very difficult because he was by then a sort of fully fledged alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And when my stepmother left him with the two children that they'd had, and I ended
Five
up
children.
Living with him... on my own and trying to go to school and kind of manage what was really a fast deteriorating situation. And he and I were living in some rented house in the far reaches of Dublin, and I'd get home from school and there would just be stuff piled in the kitchen and everything. And so I decided I had to leave, but going back to my mother's wasn't really an option. So a very nice pair of lesbian sisters, i.e. not a couple, but they said I could rent a room from them. I'd met them working in a restaurant in Dublin called The Blackboard, where I used to work at weekends. And then As a waitress, yeah. And or a waiter, as we say now. And that was for two, a lovely gay couple called Peter and Melvin, who really looked after me very well. Because, I mean, what kind of a state I must have been in, I'm no idea. But apparently I was a very good waitress.
I can imagine.
I loved it. It was my favourite job.
What did you love about it?
I loved the interaction, and I loved that it made me feel quite efficient, and I loved the whole, well, I think the theatre of it, actually, really.
I think it is a kind of drama, isn't
it? Yeah. And I just used to love but I think maybe I also just loved getting to work.
Yeah, maybe.
Because it was
school. You were still going to school, but working.
When I first started working there, and then I worked there full time for about 4 months, and then a friend of mine gave me a job in his recording studio. And so I did that until I left for London in Dublin. Yeah, that's when I met, you know, all of the people that we have in common.
Yeah,
you know,
did you meet them there?
I recorded U2's first demo tapes when I was, 15, and he was 17. He hates it when I remind him that he's older. But yeah, that was all when I was working at Keystone Studios. But after my father died, Dublin started feeling, I don't know, I think my father got offered a job at the Sunday Times probably about 4 years before he died. And I think in my head that lodged as that would have been the moment that he could have changed his life. That was the pivotal moment where things could have changed for the better. And he didn't take the job. And I think he didn't take the job because he was afraid and because he was an alcoholic. And so I think for me that always represented this sort of golden light that you could fly towards. Yeah. And so after he died, I became quite resolute about getting out. So I took the ferry from Dunleary with my friend Marie.
Who did you know in London? Oh, you had another friend.
She didn't know. She just had an address for us. She had some Irish friends who were living in a squat, or friends of friends who were living in a squat in Stoneleigh Street in West London, actually not very far from here, off Latimer Road. And we arrived there on a bright summer, sunny morning and were greeted at the door by just this crowd of Irish men, mostly. And I was like, Mairead, what was the point in coming all the way here if we're just going to live with the whole house full of Irish people? Yeah. But they were incredible to us and they were so hospitable.
Are you 16?
16.
Wow.
She's 18. And they gave us a room that there was already two of them living in, but we were allowed to share it. I mean, they were amazing days, you know. I think it was a really great time to be young.
It was great, yeah.
You know, there was huge adversity, but at the same time, life just felt full of possibility and you could afford to rent places for cheap. You know, we were only in the squat for about 3 months. And then I got a job at Blushes on the King's Road.
Blushes.
I don't know
that?
If it's still there. It was a wine bar. And it used to be so amazing on a Saturday then, you know. Bob Geldof and Paula.
Yeah, because they live right around the corner from me.
And they used to arrive on a Saturday morning at about 11 o'clock at the tube station on the King's Road. And then they would promenade up the King's Road. And they would be followed by this sort of retinue of It was like a medieval, you know, it was like Henry VIII had arrived, you know, and all these people would be following along in their wake. And again, it was like theatre, watching, you know, and it was punk, and it was just incredible and exciting.
Do you remember what you ate at that time? I mean, would you go to restaurants, or would you cook at home, or would you eat
at Blushes? I'd cook at home. Food wasn't great in London then, you know it wasn't. And also, I didn't really care so much. I mean, I was so obsessed with just survival and getting on, survival and getting on. I mean, it was the 1970s. I think there was quite a bit of sort of beef bourguignon and, you know, Black Forest ghetto, nothing to write home about. Everyone was eating spaghetti bolognese because that was very exotic and Italian, but not.
Chianti bottles with the straw.
Chianti bottles. Yeah. Beaujolais Nouveau.
Yeah, Beaujolais Nouveau.
That was always quite exciting.
Yeah.
I remember that through the 80s, but not so much the food, really.
Yeah. So you're a 16-year-old in London. You're working in Blushes. You're living in this Irish house. Your father's just died. And? Did you have a vision? Did you know you wanted to be the writer or the journalist, or did you go back to school?
So you
left school at 15?
Yeah.
Wow.
I did my, you know, the equivalent of GCSEs, and then it just wasn't possible.
Yeah.
And for a while I thought, I'll go back to school. And then I just realized that wasn't going to happen. And then I didn't really have a dream, you know, because it was very much about survival, really. Mm. And it was day to day. And I think I was just very lucky. You know, I had lots of...
You probably must have been a fantastic kid. To have that courage and to, you know, that...
But you have courage when you're that age, don't you, I think? Maybe, because you don't know. You know, now I think I'm much less brave than I was when I was 16 years old or 18 years old. Because now you have the benefit of, or not, of having seen what the world can do.
Yeah, and then you risk-free. The risk is scary, and the
jeopardy. Whereas then it's just about... you know, possibility, isn't it? And I felt possibility in London, you know, that energized me and just kept me going. You know, I mean, it wasn't easy, you know, and I missed my dad so badly, you know, because I think as a daughter, when you lose your father at that age, you kind of deify them.
Yeah.
And so I'd elevated him to this impossible kind of... Olympian height.
Yeah.
And so I spent an awful lot of my late teens and early 20s, you know, finding really broken men and trying to fix them because I felt guilty that I hadn't fixed my dad. And I really think it took me till my 30s, really, to escape from the kind of tyranny of his perfection, which, you know, and realize who he was, you know, which doesn't make me love him any less, but it certainly helped to create a more functional life for myself.
And did you drink? Well, was the fact that he died of sort of alcohol?
No, I think I drank, but I don't think... I'm not a very addictive... apart from cigarettes, which I was hopelessly addicted to for sort of all of my 20s and early 30s, which is mad because my father died of a heart attack and was a chain smoker. But drink... I mean, you know, it was the 1980s. I was in the music business. I had a lot of fun. Then, because the next thing I did was get a job at a record company.
Yeah,
I mean, because of the studio that I'd worked in Ireland. You know, it was always people who you'd met who then would introduce you to somebody else. And, you know, sometimes you'd get a little chink of an opportunity and you would grab that and then you would... And the journalism and the television only happened again just by accident. You know, I worked for this record company. I worked with Bob Geldof. Mm. I worked on Band Aid and Live Aid, and he stole my desk to sort out Band Aid from. Yeah. And, you know, I was there on the day when we all went to that studio in West London and all of those people. It was a kind of amazing, magical time. Then I set up my own little PR company. But at the same time, they were looking for a TV presenter for a music program that Channel 4 were making, and it was going to be all world music, and that was what was really exciting about it to me, because it was my father always used to bring back amazing records from Africa, Miriam Makeba, incredible music. And so I was really excited to get involved in it, and they gave me the job. I was appalling. I mean, someone sent me like a YouTube clip the other day. You know how everything lives on YouTube of me presenting.
Oh, I have to look at it.
Yeah, it was called Big World. Yeah. And I spoke in a monotone like that. And I was clearly just shit scared.
Yeah. And, they didn't
and really self-conscious.
To sort of teach you how to do that.
No, yeah. But so I did that for a couple of years. And then it just...
Did you have a domestic life as well? Did you live with anybody and have to think about a kitchen or food or bringing shopping home? Or did you just basically food was that you smoked and had food? Did you eat supper?
Smoked and drank Beaujolais Nouveau. But I did get married when I was 18 to another lost soul who's a wonderful and old friend of mine now called Richard Jobson, who was the lead singer in this punk band called The Skids.
Called? Skids, great band. Yeah,
great.
Love the Skids.
Into the Valley, working for the Yankee Dollar. Come on, Ruthie,
Never went anywhere without the Skids playing. Yeah.
But Richard was a really interesting and unusual character. He was another lost kid. He'd left home at 16. He had, you know, huge intellectual aspirations, many of which he went on to realise, and huge determination. And I think we sort of fell together out of loneliness. Mm. And we tried, you know, we gave it our best shot for two kids. And we stayed together till I was 21.
Wow, so young.
But so we had a domestic life then.
Do you remember?
And
what was
very
it like?
Rudimentary. I used to make things like grilled pork chops with mustard on them. Mm. And a lot of potatoes, spaghetti bolognese.
Did you use cookbooks? Do you remember using...
I had the Constance Spry cookbook that my mum had given me because that was sort of her Bible.
So she did cook, your mum?
Yeah, she used to bake more than cook. I mean, when I think about food that my mum made, she used to make incredible gingerbread. Mm. She did make a mean spaghetti bolognese. She made really good normal food. Mm. You know, she'd make a great shepherd's pie.
Yeah. Did she come from? She came from an English family. And
she's half Scottish, half English.
Scottish,
She was Scottish, really. But she learned. You know, she taught me how to make lobscouse, which is it's a very rudimentary Norwegian stew, which is just beef and potatoes, but cubed very small and cooked in their own broth for quite a long period of time. And she used to make these things called milkeringe, which are they're sort of yogurts, basically, that Norwegians used to make. And it was very weird because both she and my stepmother used to make these yogurts. Once I left her house and went to live with my dad, every cupboard you opened would have yogurt, you know, breeding.
Yeah, was your father's second wife Norwegian?
Wasn't. They weren't married, but I mean, she was.
But she was Norwegian.
No, she was Irish. But
so your
I
father
think
obviously
had an influence.
Yeah.
No, but they all wanted to impress
they
him.
They wanted to impress
he
him.
He had this thing,
really,
you know, which clearly worked for every woman in his life. And I don't think my mum and my stepmother were the only ones either. Mm. So,
That's the thing of cooking for, you know, seduction as well, isn't it? That people can remember. Can you remember a meal where you wanted to impress somebody and you cooked?
I've never cooked when I wanted to impress
somebody. Well, you joined by Judy Dench. She said the same thing. He came down and he said something to her like, you know, she said, this agent is coming, so I'm going to make him the best omelette. She tried to figure out how to make the best omelette. And he ate it. And she was looking and he said, I think you should stick to acting. Something like that.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future.
It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. On Purpose's mission is to create impactful conversations to help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating. You'll be laughing, crying, and have so many impactful takeaways after this interview.
I had this, like, you know, homie lover friend for a long time. He's very disrespectful to me, very kind of messed up to me. But in my mind, we could get married. We had the most beautiful babies. He handsome. I'm pretty. Like, it would be so cool. He's smart and intellectual. I'm kind of smart, I think. Like, it would be fun. We have the best conversations. Like, we have fun, but then he would treat me like crap.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
And we host Stages Podcast.
Binge close to 100 episodes. Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast. Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
Right now, I'm going to ask you, you chose of all the recipes that we have in all our books, you said that you wanted to make spaghetti vongole. So would you like to read the recipe for spaghetti vongole?
I will read the recipe for you. 4 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 4 cloves of garlic, finely chopped, 3 dried red chilies, crumbled, 3 kilos of small clams, a bunch of flat leaf parsley, finely chopped, and then in brackets divided, talk about organization. Sea salt and freshly ground black pepper, 400 grams of spaghetti, 1 lemon quartered. Fairly precise, I think, probably listeners will realize. That serves 4. You heat the oil in a large frying pan over a medium heat. Add the garlic and fry over a medium heat for 1 minute until just beginning to brown. That's where I go wrong often.
You should just have bigger pieces of garlic and then you can take them out.
Or just cook it slower.
Yeah.
Maybe. Add the crumbled chilies, clams, and 2 tablespoons of water. Cover and fry over a high heat for about 5 minutes until all the clams open, discarding any that don't. Add 1/2 the parsley to the clams. Season with salt and pepper. Drain the spaghetti and add to the clams. Serve with the remaining parsley and the lemon quarters.
And you made it with Carlotta.
Hi, I'm Carlotta. I'm a chef at the River Cafe. So I'm going to start sweating off the garlic with parsley stalks.
So it's sweating rather than frying. I think that's the important thing.
Exactly.
Isn't it? Yeah. And now a bit of chili.
Now a flick of chili.
Dry chili.
Dry chili. Yes, always dry chili. So that's starting to fry off. And at this stage, I'm going to add the clams.
So you've scrubbed them, you've done all the hard work with them, because that is the boring thing, isn't it? And these clams are from where? Because the tastiest clams, I think, come from the Bay of Naples. And I think it's partly because it's a bit grubby. Are they?
Oh, sorry. So at this point, we just want to get a little bit more heat into the pan. And then I'm going to, so usually here we use suave to put the vongole in.
Nice to sort of drink it and stick it in the dish as well. It's multi-purpose suave. You can overcook the clams as well, can't you?
Yes.
So what's too long?
You want to catch them just as they're opening up.
And will they, if you stop the heat when they're opening up, will they keep opening up the way you want them to?
They'll keep opening up, absolutely. stage, they're starting to open up. So I'm going to finish cooking the pasta in here.
So good.
And the starchy water, the wine and the oils are going to come together and thicken the sauce. So lid's going to be back on.
I bet you can flip a pancake, can't you?
Yes.
She's got brilliant pan tipping technique.
I'm going to finish it with the parsley for freshness. So there we have it.
Oh my God, that is the most spectacular thing. And now I feel confident. I love it. Thank you very much. It's a revelation.
Well, first of all, why did you choose this?
It's entirely my favourite dish, mussels and clams. Mm-hmm. And there was a period in my childhood when we lived on the west coast of Ireland in Connemara. Mm. It was on one of my mother's kind of escapes from realities, which used to happen quite often. And we went to live there for 6 months and we were very poor. Yeah. And for about a 3 month period, we just ate potatoes that we could dig up and mussels, which we picked from the rocks. And you'd think that actually that would have kind of knocked any desire to eat them ever again out of me. But I think there was a sort of 4 or 5 year hiatus, maybe a bit longer. I think probably till I first came to London and then I re-embraced them. And then I used to go to Naples with my best friend and we used to have spaghetti with cozze and fasolare from the Bay of Naples. And I mean, ever since then. And then Molly, weirdly, my daughter, from when she was a toddler, her absolute favourite thing was mussels and clams. Yeah. And it's quite odd to see a little toddler there kind of throwing the shells over her shoulder and digging into a plate of seafood. Yeah. So I think many influences have combined to make it my favourite. But I think it's really difficult to make because it's so simple.
Mm. There's no hiding it, is there?
There's no hiding. And I really love that. I love food like that. Yeah. I don't really like very complicated food, you know, sort of very French, high-end, never really enjoyed it. Much, much prefer, you know, really great fresh ingredients and a simple recipe, which is probably why I've been found here for the last... You know, I used to... I first came to the River Cafe when you first opened virtually in the 1980s.
Yeah, 1987 we opened. And when we were only open for lunch, do you remember?
You were only open for lunch, then, I think, when I first started coming. Yeah. And you used to have a wine from outside of Venice... called, I obviously wasn't paying the bills then, that was the beginning of my career, but I used to come with a friend and we used to have this wine called Where Dreams Have No End.
Oh yeah, Where Dreams Have No End, with that label, wasn't it?
It was amazing. And even then, this felt like the most glamorous place on earth because it felt decadent in all the best ways. And actually here... was one of the first places, and I know it's on a different level from the pub on Grafton Street or whatever, but it was one of the first places where I really felt that sort of babble of excitement and conversation that you get on a Friday night in a pub in Dublin. Yeah. To be passionate about something, and food is something you can be really passionate about. And I mean, with my... I was not a great sort of domestic... But I actually did go through a long period where I had a house in Sussex that I used to rent with this couple, friends of mine, Nicola and Helena, they're still my friends. And we used to cook together.
Yeah.
And they were some of the happiest years of my life.
Yeah, cooking together
every weekend. Mm. And I actually learned a lot. Nicola was a particularly good cook and they were very precise. You know, even things like a... You know, I remember her teaching me to make a basil omelette. Mm. But it's a bit like the vongole. Mm. It's only about the ingredients because it's
you
so
have to have
simple.
Good eggs, good basil.
Yeah. And you have to, you know, and that, I think, I just love the sort of satisfaction that comes from that. But then when you have kids.
Yeah, so what was that like?
Well, I loved cooking for them.
Well, going back to marrying Jason, did he grow up in a domestic house where meals, unlike yours, or was it the same?
No, very unlike mine. His mum did everything, and she was she's a really good cook. She still is, you know, I mean, very English, quite sort of 1970s. Mm-hmm. She had one of those trolleys that's hot, that keeps things hot, and she would wheel it in to sit by the table. And, you know, the plates would be in there warming and the food, lots of sort of casseroles and pot roasts and things like that. But she's a really good cook. It always looks perfect. She's a good baker as well. And Jason is probably the better cook in our house. He loves, absolutely loves cooking. And I feel like I loved it during those years in Sussex, and I loved the early days of cooking. cooking for my kids. But then something happened when they just make faces about the food you cooked and never like it. And it became such a negotiation in the house that I kind of lost the heart of it. I mean, now I'm back. But Jason sort of took over in a lot of ways.
But do you eat really healthy?
Is not the, consciously.
Just like the food that you like.
It's the food that I like.
Yeah.
I love fresh things. I love, you know, one of the things that gives me huge satisfaction is we've got a garden which during the spring period of the year is just absolutely wall-to-wall wild garlic. It can almost become noxious, the smell.
Yeah.
And I just love to gather it, and I make pesto in industrial quantities.
Good. Well, we have to. And when you go to Greece, do you cook there?
Yeah, we go to Greece a lot. I get like a craving for. I used to go to Greece from the age of 16, and so, you know, Greek islands. You get there, the smell, the pine, the Greek salad. Again, it's everything simple. I just love it. Yeah. I just love it. And so actually, you know, there we tend to eat out quite a lot. Yeah. But we'll make, you know, a big lunch with Greek salad, and we'll make some dips and things. And, you know, we might get some fish and grill it. You know, we keep it very simple.
But you have a lot of friends over. You do like, do you prefer going to people's houses or having them come to you? Or do you like both?
I prefer going to people's houses because then I don't have to clear up.
Yeah.
Jason prefers having people over because I clear up after him. Yeah. And he loves cooking. But no, we do have people over a lot. Yeah. I don't think there's anything nicer than a table full of people and they're all eating and talking. And, you know, I tend to make big stews and things that I don't have to do a lot of cook. Our kitchen is all open like yours. And when people talk to me when I'm cooking, I can't cope with it. I can't concentrate. Yeah, yeah. So I have to make things that are all ready. And I love slow cooked things and ossobuco and things like that. And
So how do you combine working with cooking? How did you bring up children and pursue your career and, you know, have a home life? Did you rush from one thing to another? Was it hard? Or did you just do it, do you think?
I think same as every woman. I mean, it's so much every woman's experience these days, isn't it? And it's kind of the bit that wasn't factored into our great desire for, you know, equality and independence. So I think it's really hard. You know, it was less hard for me because I had, you know, enough money to have help. But I think it's a really difficult thing. And I think, you know, for most women, it's a burden of responsibility that you perform it because you don't have a choice. You don't feel like you have a choice.
You know, it is really,
it's a tyranny.
I think also, as you say, it's economic, you know. And so when people say, oh, you know, there are all these kids who are growing up on pizza, McDonald's. Well, the fact is that if you have a night job and you have a choice, I like to think that maybe the mother has a choice of doing homework with her kids or cooking a fresh meal for them. Maybe cut her some, you know.
And
maybe
if you've done a pretty hard graft job that isn't based on your passion or any of the luxuries that you know some of us have, if you've done a hard graft job all day and then you get home and you've got hungry, grumpy kids, I don't think you want to sit down and start creating a meal. I mean, for all the sense of, you know, holistic happiness it might offer, I don't think you're in a place to actually think about or do that, you know.
It's tough.
Yeah.
You know, we saw in lockdown when kids didn't go for, you know, to school, they didn't have their one meal of the day. And I was, you know, talking to Jamie the other day about, you know, the goal now is to make lunches so nutritious. Because you know that's the only meal a kid's going to have.
But we should have free school meals, universally across the nation, you know. Yeah. And one of the first things we need to do is recognize that there's real hunger in this country and address it. And the idea that, you know, we can sit around and have our amazing meals and somewhere else just down the road there's a kid who isn't getting supper. It makes me feel physically sick and I just don't understand why we can't address it, you know. I mean, I spent my whole childhood worried about things like food. And I know, you know, I kind of know the smell of poverty and I'm frightened to death of it, you know, and I've run so far in the opposite direction, but I'm still, you know, rubbish at kind of handling it because it's a fear. It's a deep, deep rooted fear. And we're bringing up, you know, a whole generation of kids are experiencing that. Yeah.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. On Purpose's mission is to create impactful conversations to help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating. You'll be laughing, crying, and have so many impactful takeaways after this interview.
I had this, like, you know, homie lover friend for a long time. He's very disrespectful to me, very kind of messed up to me. But in my mind, we could get married. We had the most beautiful babies. He handsome. I'm pretty. Like, it would be so cool. He's smart and intellectual. I'm kind of smart, I think. Like, it would be fun. We have the best conversations. Like, we have fun. But then he would treat me like crap.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
When you're working at, you know, on your column, when you're writing on your campaigns, on your books, do you eat?
Well, you know what? Since I started my radio show at the Times, I've lost a lot of weight. I mean, not a lot, but I've definitely got thinner. Not intentionally, but because it's a lunchtime show, and lunch is my favorite meal. Like, I can eat like a horse at lunchtime. Yeah. I love it. I can still sleep at night, you know, because once you're menopausal and postmenopausal, sleep can become a bit of a challenge. And so lunch is my favorite meal. Mm. And 4 days a week, I can't have lunch.
So
and
what do you do?
I just don't eat until after I finish my show. So I end up having maybe 1.5 meals a day. You know, I have supper, but I have
breakfast,
high tea supper. I always eat about 6:30 or 7. Yeah. I don't really like breakfast very much. At weekends, I have breakfast. I make breakfast for the kids at the weekend. I love doing that. Yeah. You know, it makes you feel, there's so few moments as a parent, I think, where you feel, I've got this, you know, and making them breakfast is one of them, you know, whether it's banana pancakes or scrambled eggs and bacon or whatever, avocado on toast. I mean, it's ridiculous. My children are now 17 and 18 and they still at the weekends will come in and kind of go, what's for breakfast, Mum?
Yeah, but that will never stop.
I hope it doesn't, because it makes me feel useful.
I agree. I think going home and being fed and I think, you know, we all grow up with kind of role models. I certainly, you know, did, and I see myself sort of acting. My mother was incredibly child-oriented. You know, she never blamed a child, never told off a child. The child was always right. Or my, you know, we had a lot of way that we kind of grew up. But I think for somebody who didn't grow up with that and then to be the way they are, it's like, you know, it's so inspiring to me because it's, you know, so that you've come from maybe, you know, your father's, but you had love, you know, I guess.
I had love. Yeah. You know what? Yeah. And I always think about this because, you know, they say that basically we shape our children by the time they're 5 or 6. Mm. And I think I was really lucky because the one thing that they were really good at was they made me feel very loved. Mm. And once you have that, it gives you a confidence to step out into the world and you know, stick your toe in the water and see what's out there. And I think, you know, without that, that's when the real damage sets in. And so all of the other things were pretty survivable. But I think without that early love, and we were definitely, you know, my mum was an amazing mum, particularly when we were little, before things got difficult. But I'm very interested, I have to ask you one question, which is, were you interested in food even when you were a teenager and in your 20s, or was it your mother-in-law that inspired you really with food?
I would say that my mother was, here we go, see, did you, what was it? Don't you think? Don't you find? Here we go. The story is that my father was a doctor and my mother was a librarian. And I think they both came, they were immigrant. Their families were, they were born in the Lower East Side and then, you know, Jewish immigrants who came, Ellis Island, all that. And I think that for them, the whole thing was education. Whereas my grandparents were very focused on food. I think both my mother was trying to get, she went back to college when we were like 5 or 6 to be a librarian. And my father was, you know, trying to make it as a doctor. And I think that we always ate fresh food. We always ate well. We sat around, you know, that thing of sitting around the table. But probably I romanticize it. Probably the food we had. My sister is much more scathing. I think that the conversation was more important than what we ate. But yeah, we ate well. We never had delivered or packaged
spaghetti
food.
Spaghetti with
or,
golden syrup.
No, we didn't have spaghetti with golden syrup. For me, it all opened up when I did come to Europe. Going to Italy and then living in Paris as we did, that was the kind of food, you know, inspiration.
But I think there's something about Italian food, though, as well, because most of it, maybe, you know, some of it's complicated, but most of it is about fresh ingredients and simplicity. And it's very seductive. You know, I became interested in food, as I said to you, when I used to go and stay with my friend Natalie, you know, because this was amazing food. Natalie from Naples. Because it wasn't performance food. Yeah. It was just amazingly good food. And, you know, they wouldn't have beans on toast at 4 o'clock in the morning. As I said, they would make a pasta.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, you know, a lot of Italian men can cook as well, which I, you know, still find really impressive. You know, I'm lucky because I married a man who can cook, but the number of my friends who sort of look at Jason wistfully and go, oh, I wish mine could do that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So we've talked about the work. We've talked about the children. We've talked about, you know, the husband who cooks. Maybe we should wind up on the comfort food and ask you if food is sharing and love and memories. Certainly memories. Your memories are about food.
It's about food and memory, and I also think that our emotional lives are often channeled through food. So when food isn't good, I mean, it is a bit like water for chocolate or whatever. You know, when food isn't good, it's because other things aren't good. And that's why, you know, the bad meals are as almost defining memories as the good meals, you know. And for me, sitting down at a table and having something simple and delicious with my kids sitting opposite me and my husband sitting at the table, it does feel, in some ways, not to be too saccharine about it, but like a sort of dream come true. And the table is the place where that theatre of it plays out. And I look around and think, gosh, you know, aren't I lucky?
Yeah,
I got this.
Yeah, you are, and we are. And do you have a comfort food that you go to when that's what you needed?
Well, all the way through my 20s, I used to go and stay with my best friend, Natalie, in Naples.
Another best friend. How many best friends? I'm getting friend jealousy here.
I've got two best friends.
Okay.
That's best friends, but that's really, you know, I've known them since I was 18 years old.
I'll get over this. Okay.
And we used to cook aglio olio. And we used to cook it at 4 o'clock in the morning when we came back from the nightclub in Capri, where we used to go. We used to cook it in the middle of the afternoon if we got peckish. We used to cook it if one of us was sobbing.
Yeah.
You know, and so in many ways, that still is my sort of go-to comfort food. But the other thing I've learned to cook quite recently is this delicious, I call it porridge bread. Mm-hmm. It is an Irish recipe, and it is very much porridge bread because it's just made with oats and seeds and live yogurt and a spoon of baking powder. And it's incredibly easy to make, foolproof.
It doesn't.
No yeast.
No flour.
And no flour.
Yes.
And it's so delicious.
What's
it's quite
Irish
dense.
Bread? What's that called?
Well, it's like soda bread. It's
soda
like
bread.
The wheaten bread.
Yeah.
It's very like that, which is also another sort of comfort food.
And so you take all these grains and you add them.
And the oats.
And the oats.
And the yogurt and the baking powder. And you just put it all in a bowl, mix it all together, put it into a loaf tin in baking paper, you know. And you have to cook it for about 50 minutes altogether. You cook for 40 minutes one side and then tip it over. Mm. It's rock hard on the outside. It's absolutely moist and delicious on the inside. And that with a thick layer of butter.
Okay, I love butter. We love butter. Richard's mother used to say that butter was the best cheese, and she was a Northern Italian. But if you think about butter like a cheese, then you can have that thick piece with a little thin bit of bread, you know.
Yeah, yeah, you just want the bread as a carrier for the butter, isn't it? I think that's butter. And that's very Irish as well.
Yeah, true. And we're going to go right now into the River Cafe, and you're going to meet a friend and have dinner, aren't you?
I am. I'm so excited.
So nice. Who are you having dinner with tonight, then? Go on. I'm allowed to ask that question. It's my restaurant.
You can. It's not my husband for a change. Okay. I have a gentleman guest.
Good.
I'm having dinner with your friend and mine, Danny Houston.
Oh, so
fabulous, isn't he? And he's about to do my podcast, Books to Live By, and I'm so excited to talk to him because, you know, he's going to pick the five books that have shaped his life. Mm. In many ways, it's the literary companion to this one.
Food and reading. Go see Danny. And thank you, Mariella. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.